G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White is ready to roll at White HQ. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Daniel. I'm looking forward to today's show. I love when there's lots of different sports to discuss and people to speak to, and today's no exception, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes,
really looking forward to it.
Me too. I do like the variety that Joey's been able to produce for us every now and then. Sometimes it gets lazy, but outside of that. Did he just give me the bird? I think he did. Anyway, it's nice to have Joey with us back in the studio. Speaking of Joey, he was very excited last night, Whitey, because there was some action at Ninja Warrior. He's very, very quick to get on the group WhatsApp chat and tell us about what was happening at Ninja Warriorville. Now, I don't know where that is or how that looks these days, but his first message was, "We've done it! We've done it! Someone's conquered the mountain!" And I thought, it's pretty cool. That's for a nice work from Joey. He's very excited about that. It's at the Melbourne Showgrounds, he tells me. And then he does it again. Oh, there's another one! And then 5 minutes later, there's another one! It's like the school sports yesterday at Ninja Warrior. Everyone gets to win. Is that what happens on these TV shows?
I don't know. It's not one of my shows, I must confess. But I thought he loved his footy, Joey. But rather than watch the footy, he was watching some reality television
Well, I think
type
he worked
stuff.
Out that the Magpies, who he loves more than anything in the world, which
yes,
is a concern,
correct.
Very, very large concern.
It's real sort of teenage sort of prepubescent type love for his football team.
Teenage girl sort of Justin Bieber type relationship. Like, it's that sort of love and affection. It's quite unnerving at times. But regardless, he saw the teams that were announced for the Magpies, and he's gone, oh, not much point getting involved in the footy these days. So I'm going to Ninja Warrior myself. Silly. And all I could do, Whitey, was think of you.
Why is that?
Well, as a Ninja Warrior. Because of your regime at the moment, you're just about there.
Well, I'm doing a lot of things. and I'm feeling a lot fitter. I'm into my fifth week. I'm still not really losing weight, but I feel like I am losing weight, and I feel like I'm getting fitter, but it's not reflective on the scales. So I think I need a new set of scales. But I'm feeling pretty good.
I'm feeling pretty good. It's all about how you feel.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's sort of... It is and it isn't really. But no, I'm continuing my... Every half time in these night games through the footy frenzy, I'm doing my push-ups and sit-ups and step-ups and these sorts of things. So last night I did them quite late in the piece because it was quite late by the time we got to half-time in the Hawthorn-Freo game. Yeah. But anyway,
you need to go half-time the first game.
No, well, that's when you... See, this is the thing with young children, and this footy frenzy is like the Big Bash. It's fantastic, but it's also a nightmare at the same time. So it was showers and fruit and yogurt at halftime in the St Kilda Geelong game, and all those things had to be done before the second half started. So it was like a pit stop type setup in a Formula One Grand Prix. There's a lot going on. but we got there. Well, we didn't really. We had two very emotional children watching Hawthorn play last night. Tired. It was bad parenting. They shouldn't have been watching it, but they were. They couldn't cope. When Isaac went off, it was just a
homeschooling situation, haven't you? You've fallen for that. Because they're not going to school tomorrow, so you let them stay up. You've fallen for the old chestnut.
Well, yeah, yes and no. Look, homeschooling is a challenge in a lot of ways, but we tried to explain to Campbell that it was too late to be watching the football, and then we realised that about 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon he'd done his entire work for the week to prove that he was able to watch the football. So we felt that there needed to be some sort of reward for this.
No.
So I don't know what the rest of the week looks like.
No, anyway. That's a nightmare.
Anyway, now I don't want to talk about it because it was got really quite tense last night, and I don't know what the fallout's necessarily going to be today.
Well, he won't be up early doors. I can give you the tip. He won't be knocking on the door saying, "Let me in, Dad. Let me do my footy tips."
Now, before we reflect on the football, Daniel, because there's a lot to take out of what happened last night, I do want to mention the golf. Now, we're talking to Gabby Ruffles later on, and I'm really looking forward to that because we did follow her through last week, particularly on that final day and the drama that was attached to that. Mm. But Colin Morikawa.
My name's Cole.
We know about Colin Morikawa because earlier this year, we didn't really know much about Colin.
Which was probably
poor, particularly from me who prides himself on his golf, that we didn't know much about Colin.
No, you can't keep track of everything, boy.
Now, Colin has, as we sit here and discuss Colin this morning, Colin has been a professional for 14 months.
Right.
And Colin has now won three times on the PGA Tour, including a major championship at just his second attempt at any major. He played in the US Open last year. He's going quite well, is Colin, and he's putting together figures that are Tiger Woods-like, because since he became professional, he's only missed, I think, one cut, including his first 22 starts. He made the cut. Now, Tiger was 25 starts, and Colin did it in 22. And at just 23 years of age, we're talking about a major champion and someone that's already won three times. And it's this group of young Americans particularly that are coming through. And you can put in Victor Hovland from Scandinavia and a couple of other guys from Europe, but predominantly from America, that have no fear, that hit the ball nearly 400 metres, and can do really good things. And Morikawa on the 16th, it was a congested leaderboard. It looked like Jason Day was a massive chance of winning. And on the par 4 300 metre 16th, Morikawa's put it to 12 feet with a driver and hold the putt for eagle. And it was all she wrote, pretty much, because no one else could do what Colin did.
Well, they tried. They tried on 16, most of them, to drive that green. But Colin had a moment that I think he'll remember for the rest of his days, to be able to step up onto the tee box and go whooshka to 7 feet on the 16th green and tap in for eagle. And that was all she wrote. All he had to do was hit fairways from there, and he was sweet. Very, very impressive work from Colin. I think we've underestimated the chip in on 14, because his approach to 14 very, very poor approach to 14. Short iron, left it short and right, and then he chips in for Birdie Town. And I think there might have been some juice flowing after that for our man Cole. He ends up lifting the trophy, hoisting the trophy and losing the lid in the way.
That's right. That's right. The lid came off. I think it is amazing how many times, Daniel, that whoever wins, and it doesn't necessarily need to be a major championship, but someone who just wins an event, something special has to happen. A bit of luck involved in the special. On that final day to win. Amazing when you reflect back on someone's last 18 holes, they've chipped in or they've holed a really long putt or the ball's hit a tree and bounced back out onto the fairway. Something's happened to sort of get their round going. And, you know, as I said, Colin was part of a really packed leaderboard, and he did a couple of things in the space of about half an hour that separated him from the rest of the field. Jason Day was a massive chance. I thought he was going to win, I must confess, there at one point.
Did you?
Because he was ahead of a lot of the other leaders on the golf course. So he would get to 16 first, which was the drivable par 4 16th. And unfortunately for Jason, he hit the ball in the greenside bunker and couldn't get up and down for birdie. So he only made par, and didn't get that separation from the field when I thought he was going to. So he finished inside the top three, which is a terrific. It's terrific to see. I mean, Jason polarises opinion, but the reality is he is Australian. And also, when he's playing well, he's one of the most entertaining golfers to watch on the planet. And it's great to see him back contending again, because he's got an amazing record in major championships of being in contention. He's had his issues, and it was good to see him back playing well.
Was nice to see him do good things. Nice to see Aussie back up there at the top of the leaderboard in a major championship. It's been a while since it's been Jason. It's been a while since it's been out there. Surviving four rounds, Jason, really, in the grand scheme of things. And that's not to be nasty. That's just the reality. He just doesn't finish a lot of tournaments of recent years. He just pulls out or he doesn't play. It was good to see him go well. But your man, Cole, is a very, very fine young man. Now, I think I saw yesterday that 23-year-olds to win the USPGA Championship, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, and then Cole. So that's pretty rare for Cole. What's happened to Rory? Rory hasn't won one for a while now at major championships.
No, he hasn't. No, he hasn't. As I said earlier this year, it's great to see Rory back playing good golf because I think golf needs Rory to play well because he's got that personality, both the way he plays, but also just being Rory. As good as Colin was, he is off this production line, as I mentioned before about these Americans that don't necessarily show a lot of emotion. They're trackman golfers, as a lot of people say. I think we need the likes of Rory and John Rahm to play and play well to be up there. I think it's good for the golf. But I don't know with Rory. There's something seems to be missing. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, victory. Trophies at the moment seem to be missing. He doesn't finish strong anymore. If he's just on your back with six holes to play, you'd be backing yourself in to beat him because he'll find a way to do some vomiting or not be able to manage the big moments and close. So, which is something eight years ago, you would have thought, Rory's coming. I'm toast here. But now he's not.
Well, in 2014, so we're talking 6 years ago now.
6 years ago, yeah.
He won both the Open Championship and the PGA, and he had four majors to his name by the end of 2014, and he hasn't won one since. But in that time, he has finished inside the top 10 on eight occasions. So he is still playing well, but he's not winning the way he was. And he's always been someone that struggles at times to sort of finish off results because he always is in contention. So he's won plenty of times, but also he's lost plenty of times, if that makes sense, where he's been in contention and hasn't been able to win. So if you look through his career, he's won 14 times on the European Tour and 18 times on the PGA Tour. So it's a good record, but as I said, he's so often in contention. So often in contention. Where you think he's going to win and he doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. He just doesn't win. He just doesn't get the job done. Well, Rory, but our man Colin does. He knows how to win. He is a winner, as you say, three times already, plus the major championship in... How many starts? 22 starts?
No, he's the cut situation. He made his first 22 starts. So he's only had about 28 starts, I think, Colin.
I mean, his winning ratio is very, very solid. Very solid from our man, Cole. Good luck to him. Hey, did you see, digressing a little bit, the Masked Singer last night, they unveiled their first singer. Didn't see who it was.
So, Joey watched The Ninja and you watched The Masked Singer.
No, far from. I just saw it this morning when I was flicking through Twitter.
Yeah. No, it was Mark Philippoussis, wasn't it?
Mark Philippoussis! How is anyone ever going to guess Mark Philippoussis is going to be singing songs with a mask, with a costume on?
What? Well, they give clues. They give clues.
Right. Yeah. Right. What clues did they give for our man, the Poo?
I don't know. I didn't watch it, but I did watch it last year, and I don't know why, but I did. But this is the problem with either the Big Bash or the football. When it's on, in this house, that's what's on. We watch it. So everything else doesn't get consumed. It's not healthy, really, for family life, but it's what it is. Right. I'm really questioning myself as a parent at the moment because my two boys sit there on the couch and they can reel off the ads word for word. So James is five. He's sitting at the table yesterday having lunch and he says, he wants some steel blue boots. I said, what are the steel blue boots?
He needs them.
And he rehearses the ad about the steel blue boots.
Well, it's not so much your parenting. It's just the ability of the young brain to absorb information. That's what it is. It's just great learning. It's just any feedback they get, they absorb it. And they're able to regurgitate at their mercy. No, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. Whitey. There's some Europa League action going on at the moment, Whitey. Quarter-final action of the Europa League. Inter Milan and Leverkusen are playing at the moment. 2-1 in favour of Inter, 66 minutes in. And also Manchester United are playing against Copenhagen. And they are locked at a 0-0 arm wrestle, 61 minutes in to quarter-final action of the Europa League. I think the round of 16s for the Europa League were in March, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a fair wait between round of 16 and quarterfinals.
Yes. Well, we've got this situation now. Between now and probably the next 3 or 4 weeks, there's going to be a lot of European football action, Champions League, Europa League, whatever it's called now. So, yeah, that's what's going to happen. To the Baker, yes, I did take the 50s on Jason Day. So, yes, I did have that sort of moment where I thought, when we talked about it, he mentioned it in the news. I'd already taken the $29, I think it was, at the start of the tournament, but I took the 50s when I heard at 8 o'clock that he was 3 shots from the lead and 50 to 1.
Didn't back, are you listening, but you backed Jason Day at 50s.
No, it was when, what's the name, Trent Lankscale was doing the report.
Nick Quinn it was yesterday. Probably Trent today, but Nick Quinn yesterday. You'll need to know this. Did you see the broadcast rights situation for rugby, Rugby Australia? Their revolutionary broadcast package has reignited interest from Optus Sport. They're in the game. The telco's going to land the rights to 15-man code in a stunning coup, they tell us in the news today. Fox Sports set the bid for club rugby only after Rugby Australia announced broadcasters could pick and choose content from their packages for the next 5 years, from 2021 to 2025. News Corp Australia understands. I'm reading the News Corp papers today in heraldsun.com.au. The new deal will involve Optus and Network 10 screening Wallabies, Test and Super Rugby, although there's some disagreement between them regarding the finer details. Now, Optus, of course, own the English Premier League and European Champions League at the moment, as well as the Japanese and Korean competitions. They've been strongly tipped to take the Australian A-League from Fox Sports this season as well. So Optus Sports, this is sort of the future of broadcasting, perhaps, for a lot of sporting bodies, Whitey, that it won't necessarily be on terrestrial television or cable television. It will be on streaming services like Optus.
Yeah, and that's just the reality of where we're at in life, I think. It's going to be very untraditional for the older people in the world, for the younger people in the world. Yeah, I think so. as I keep being reminded by my wife, I'm a very old 42-year-old. But I think there are a number of younger people where that's just what it is. That's how you consume it. You get your Chromecast, or you get you watch it on your phone, or your tablet. You have a really smart TV, whatever it is, and it's, you know, you have 5 or 6 different accounts, and that's how you consume your sport. So I think that's just the reality of where we're at with life. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. I just think it's where we are.
15 to 20 million.
Become a pretty big player.
Well, seemingly, if they're going to be owning everything, sports fans will eventually need to, if they want to keep consuming the product, subscribe or do whatever they need to do with that service and be a part of it. And it all started with Premier League, and no one was happy about that.
Yeah. No, and what you just said before, I think, is the key, is that you'll need to. You know, I know when Foxtel lost the Premier League, I certainly aren't as interested in it as I was. I don't watch it because I can't be bothered finding out how to get Optus and all that sort of stuff, and another account and all these sorts of things. There are some of the golf tournaments now. You need golf TV to be able to watch some of all of the WGC events, and you end up, I can't be bothered. I don't want 6 or 7 accounts. But I think it's getting to the point now, well, if you're going to be stubborn and immature like me, you're not going to be able to watch your sport.
The NBL at the moment, the world of domestic basketball in Australia. The Commish, Jeremy Lullig, has been good enough to join us on a Tuesday morning. Good morning, Commish.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Geez, you're up nice and early.
Just for you guys, not normal.
This you're is a good CEOs man. Do, Daniel. CEOs, they go to gyms at
5
o'clock
open,
in
mate.
The morning or go to 11 o'clock at night. Or they'll do it in their own home gym because they work crazy hours.
I'm on the treadmill.
Are you?
No.
Totally. Oh, you've been there, though. just keep up the appearances, Jeremy. Tell us, you've announced this morning the establishment of the NBL Return to Competition Task Force for the 2020-21 season. How challenging has that been to set that up, and what does that look like to get basketball back on track in this environment?
Yeah, look, setting up the task force has probably been the easiest thing we've done this year. We've got really great support from across the community. Everything else has been challenging, but we are some really important stakeholders and representatives of different parts of different industries to come and help us out in terms of a guiding hand. And without exception, they all said yes, they were happy to help. And I think that's a testimony to the fact that everyone wants to see live sport back in full arenas sometime this year. And so we're very, very pleased that we've got some guiding lights to help us navigate these challenging times.
And you do have some challenges to get it back on court, and I imagine you would have to prioritise some over the others. I mean, you've got the travel restrictions that we're currently facing in Australia and what that might look like going forward, health and safety protocols, you've got fans attending games, financial impact on teams. How do you prioritise which ones that need to get more love than others at this stage?
Well, look, the reality is the priority has to be the safety and well-being of our players and the teams associated with the players, and then, of course, the fans if they happen to be in venue. And then everything else has to fall in around that. Now, a lot of the other things that you mentioned then basically boil down to the commercial side of things. And to that extent, it's absolutely fundamental that we have our fans in venue, and they are the lifeblood of our sport in more ways than one. Yes, they create the atmosphere and make our game day entertainment what it's known for being, but also we're so heavily reliant on gates and ticketing in order to make sure that these clubs remain sustainable and viable. So those are the two competing priorities, I guess, and then you have to take into account all of the other regulatory regimes that are forming, reforming, I guess, all the time around the country and indeed New Zealand. So, as you said, travel restrictions, the number of people that you can have at mass gatherings, they're all the bits that you don't have a choice but to prioritise. So it's not an easy set of factors, and what this group are helping us do is bring a whole bunch of different perspectives from different people who make up those, I guess, competing interests. And you've got, I mean, to give you a quick idea of who's on the panel, you've obviously got representation from the league in myself and Larry Kesselman and our chairman Graham Wade, but then a number of our sponsors, including Jack Cowan from Hungry Jacks and Greg O'Neill from La Trobe Financial. But Greg is also the chairman of the Australian Basketball Players Association, so players are represented. Former chairman of Basketball Australia and current Qantas executive Rob Marcolina. Team owners represented from Melbourne United and the Adelaide 36ers, and then some bastions of commercial industry as well, the likes of Ruffy Jaminda and Glenn Rainsbury from the Live Entertainment Industry Forum. So it's a really heavy-hitting panel. And then you throw in a government advisory in Chris Lamont, the New South Wales Small Business Commissioner. It's a really well-rounded group. And so they are going to help us to balance those priorities, but also not just help us in terms of deciding what decisions to make, but critically when we make them. And we have to start from that December start date and work our way backwards and almost figure out what the drop-dead dates are for all the different mission-critical decisions that we need to make.
So I've got a couple of questions, Jeremy. Firstly, on what happened with Melbourne United, and I think it's kind of caught everybody by surprise that we had the COVID hit NBL basketball. Did that unnerve you at all, or unnerve the NBL, just how easily and innocently it can actually take hold of a basketball club?
No, I think it did. The reality is that there must have been one or two people who came to training with COVID, and the fact that everyone there was going through all of the protocols that were in place. As you know, government have returned to train protocols, all of which were being rigorously implemented and all of which were comfortable, were complied with, and yet that wasn't sufficient to prevent the spread in that kind of setting. And as you say, what caught us by surprise, I guess, and it shouldn't, but I think it's a stark reminder every time it happens, is just how contagious this thing is. I think there were 14 players who were scrimmaging who ended up with COVID as a result of that one or two player coming to training with the virus. Now, that should be a reminder to everyone of just how incredibly contagious this thing is, that it took one session of proximity with one another for it to basically tear through. And I won't say tear through the team, because it wasn't the fully-fledged Melbourne United team was there. It was a group of training players and others who were trying to stay fit and in shape as well. But through a group of 14 people, it was quite decimating. And so everyone has had to take a step back and say, well, you can't rely on, I guess, the bare minimum in terms of government protocols. Let's stand back and actually do a more rigorous analysis of the risk to the sport in the longer term, between now and the beginning of the season at least. And, of course, South East Melbourne, as a result, have also cancelled their training sessions for the time being until we're all comfortable that this thing is settled down here in Melbourne.
Rodney Eve, when you talk about experience in the game, there's not too many better in terms of time in it. 259 games as a player, 377 games as a coach. That's over 650 games involved or thereabouts. Rodney Eve, happy Tuesday to you.
Happy Tuesday, Daniel. Happy football festival. And to you, Adam. How's things? Hey,
how are you going with the football festival, Rocket? How are you enjoying nightly football?
Not too bad. I had to turn off it last night. But you're always going to get some bad games at some stage, aren't you? So I must admit the last, I think we talk about it ad nauseum, Adam, is at least you have a general feeling the last, you always say a couple of weeks, but probably the last 8-9 days that teams are trying to score, so it makes it a better spectacle. With both teams are going back. Last night was a bit of a snore fest, wasn't it? That couldn't score and probably didn't want to score at stages, but generally the football hasn't been too bad.
Footy's been okay. Although the Cats scored pretty heavily last night, Rocket. They ended up with their second highest score of the season, 49-93.
Yes, Cats. Yeah, they certainly did a demolition, didn't they, on the Saints. And I think the Saints, it's going to happen. I think where they were on the ladder probably falsified where they're at as a team. They're probably, overachieved the right phrase, but they're not a top four side yet. And I think we're talking off air, Adam and I think they've been able to win some games against some lower sides, but I think they've taken the game on, but that opens themselves up. And I think they've got some holes in their team, and I think they get exposed by some good teams. I know they beat Port, beat Richmond with a lot of injuries, but Geelong done the homework on them, stopped their run, were able to block the corridor and score on the turnover. And now they kick some goals to stoppages as well. So I think the Saints will make the eight, but I think it'll be next year or the year after, but it'll be when they'll improve a lot.
It was one of those games last night where we're going to find out a lot about both of those teams, St Kilda and Geelong, and I think we found out a lot about Geelong. The thing about the Cats all year, I think, have been, and we've always known them to be very good defensively, but the question was whether they were going to be able to be a little bit more proactive, offensive when they had the footy. Well, last night they did both. They kept St Kilda to 4 goals and kicked 14 goals themselves. And I think, you know, you look at what happened after quarter time, it was 2 goals to St Kilda and 12 goals to Geelong. So that's dominant. But St Kilda didn't kick a goal after the 15-minute mark of the second quarter. They didn't kick one. Whereas Geelong kept wanting to score when they had the football. And I think that was, I think that's a really good sort of point of moving forward, that the Cats are getting the balance better, Daniel, between defence and offence, or defence and offence.
Think about this, Whitey, even further to that 15-minute mark of the second term stat for St Kilda kicking their last goal. They kicked 1 goal in general play. They kicked 3 goals out of centre bounces. So for the entire game, they kicked 1 goal from general play. I mean, the Cats put on an absolute coaching clinic last night and a structural masterclass against the Saints. And I was interested to talk to you about this today, Rocket. For a team like St Kilda that seemed to want to run and gun a fair bit, if you can lock away those lanes to run in, it forces them into a totally different system. Are they teams that you'd like to play against? If you're a team like the Cats that own the ball and take time in possession and then work the ball up systematically, is that almost the perfect team to play against, a team like the St Kilda pattern or the system they use?
Yeah. I think the point is, and I think we discussed it last week, is probably be able to have A, B and C game plan style. And I think the Bulldogs have got one style, and then everyone seems now they've unlocked that mystique and probably have for a while, that, you know, you put the pressure around the ball and have layers around, you know they're going to handball, eventually turn it over. The Saints, I think, caught teams by surprise per se, but it takes a while for the homework to be done. And I think they're doing their homework, you know, block those lanes, then keep the ball off them. They've got, as I said, they've got a few holes in their team which can be exposed. And I think the Suns did that a bit to them as well. I think the Saints mucked around with the ball, tried to invent things that weren't there. And I think like the Richmond game style, under real heat, you just got to keep the ball going forward. Well, I don't think there was enough pressure from the Saints last night. So, but to answer your question, yeah, I think if he can put enough pressure on their run and carry and block that ball coming back into the corridor, or if it comes back in once and they can't play on, they tend to struggle, the Saints.
100 marks for the Cats last night. I mean, it was slice and dice. It was surgical precision, the way that they just kept possession of the ball. And if you haven't got the ball, you can't score, which is one of the things that annoys a lot of footy fans at the moment with teams and the way they sometimes play rocket. But if you can work the ball up the field without ever really being a risk of turning the ball over because the opposition are going to give you free kicks. Like, it was 86 uncontested marks last night for Geelong. If you're going to allow them uncontested marks, they will slice and dice you all day long. There's got to be more pressure on those short options, doesn't there?
Yeah, there is. I think you mentioned there about controlling the ball, but they controlled the ball quite quickly without being ballistic. They weren't like Freo. Freo controlled the ball, but very slowly. It was very measured. And the Hawks didn't do a very good job with that. But the Cats were actually able to pick holes against St Kilda. St Kilda seemed to collapse their defence. They seemed to, well, their players seemed to go, like Sydney, will go back to the back 50 and defend, where they just left holes for the Cats, which they're able to get forward quite quickly, but at the same time be able to set up behind the ball and defend. So I think defensively the Saints fell apart a bit. They didn't come forward to defend. They needed to come forward and be able to, as you say, block those short kicks, put pressure on, block the holes. So therefore, it would force the Cats to go longer with their possession, but they weren't able to do that. And I think the bonus for the Cats too, Gary Rowan was able to play really well. I mean, Hawkins kicked five, but Gary Rowan was a real live wire. So you've got two or three really good options up there on the forward line. It really puts pressure on the opposition. But I think the Saints got their defensive structures all wrong, their system wrong last night.
We saw also, guys, Geelong show evidence of the players that are sort of picking up the slack, for whether it be that Ablett's not playing or Dangerfield's playing forward, or the case of Tim Kelly not being at the footy club anymore. But Sam Menegola, his season's quite remarkable. Through 11 games, on 7 occasions, he's had 20 disposals or more, but he's also been a goal kicker in a lot of the games as a midfielder, and he's giving them that extra layer. A bit taller than a normal midfielder, and he's becoming a consistent player, Rocket.
He is. Like, you think it was his first year. He had a really good season. Then I think with the abundance of riches they had, they sort of forced him out a bit, I suppose, to half four. And he wasn't as effective or as a dominant player as he was in that first year. But he's such a good kick. Like, he can kick goals from outside 50. Like, he's a really nice kick. And I think it's gone unnoticed a bit with them. I've kept an eye on teams who manage players. They've managed their players quite well so far. Pulling them out of the side, Dangerfield that game, Mushy at full forward. Their two big games were last night and next week, and then they've got a couple of easy games. So I would think those easy games, they'd manage more players. They'd probably have their best side in next week. But they've done that really well, and I think Menegola has been able to, and Parfitt's another one who's responded by playing more in the midfield. So they've actually got an evolution going on, evolving their midfield at the same time, while they've been able to manage players as well. So that all goes well for the finals for them.
And they've kind of always done that, Geelong, quite cleverly, the way they've managed players. And this year was always going to be the year where management was going to be, you know, a key part of the armoury of successful teams. But before this game last night, the Cats were $15 to win the premiership. They weren't really talked about as a premiership-winning team, but we always knew that this was the week for them. They've passed the first test. This Port Adelaide game on Friday night is intriguing because they've clearly kept Dangerfield and Selwood out of the fire, I think, to get them ready for this Friday night. So it's going to be fascinating, that game.
It is. I think Selwood's a bit more forced because he had the hamstring. It was interesting to me, the three players they managed this week were three young players and then three experienced, I'm not middle experienced, no, guys who have played 50-plus games or 80 games have come back in to strengthen their team. I think they'll I think they'll go all out next week against Port and have their best team and then play. It'll be interesting with Selwood. I don't know what the day break they've got with that hamstring. I think that'll be like Richmond have done with Cochin. No, the break's too short from a player coming off a hamstring to play again. So it depends what they do with Selwood. But, yeah, I think they'll pick as good a team as they can for next week and then they'll start managing players with game time. And I think you've just got to do it scientifically. You know, take game loads, how the game's going, how they're feeling. Anyone feeling any tightness at all or any sort of, you know, you wouldn't play them. Just wouldn't take the risk. But if they're right, okay, you might be able to manage their game time by through the interchange or up in a forward line. At the moment, they're looking quite good.
Well, they were really good last night, the Cats. It was a demolition of the Saints Whitey up there at the Gabba.
Yeah, I know you want to talk about other things, but just talking about managing players out on the field, last night, Selwood and Stephen both only played 69% of the game.
Yeah,
so, and with Dangerfield spending a lot of time at full forward, that's how they're doing it. And Dangerfield sort of spoke a little bit about it after the game, about what they're purposefully doing out on the field at the moment. But I thought, you know, that's quite instructional, just having a look at those percentages. And even Cam Guthrie, who'd got a lot of the footy over the last month, he himself only had 74% game time last night, which was lower than what would normally be the case.
Yeah. So there's three ways of doing it, isn't it? There's obviously not play them. Is be positional and seize actual game time within the game. And but they've got to control the game. Like, if that game's tight, those players probably play a bit more. So I would think back office that they would then put in their matrix and about game time and what position they play and how they're feeling and do all those questions and then be able to make a scientific decision on it. And and it's quite smart. I think you've got to be able to be prepared to use 30-odd players. It's interesting with Collingwood next week, with their injuries, and obviously they've set themselves, oh, no, this game we are going to rest A, B, C and D, like Moore's one. But now they've got all these injuries, they're still going to rest them. So they're really a skeleton of the side that they were 4 or 5 weeks ago. So you run the risk. And now they're the games they've got to win. Now they lost to Fremantle. They can't afford to lose to Adelaide. So by resting so many... and plus they've got the injuries. It's going to be an interesting byline to the story as well.
Trent Woodhill is on the line, though. He's the BBL cricket consultant. It's an interesting term he's got, or title he's got, player acquisition and cricket consultant. I want to find out more about that. He joined us. Trent, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing?
We are going very well, thank you. Appreciate your time as always. Player acquisition and cricket consultant for the Big Bash League. What does that mean, Trent?
it's a few roles probably squeezed into one. It's ensuring the Big Bash can target as many of the best overseas players who are available each season and do our best as a tournament or a league to attract the best players going forward. We've done a pretty good job of that. But there's also a lot of competition now around the place with different leagues. So it's important as a league that we're always refining what we do and providing an environment for overseas players to want to return. And that's pretty important. And then the other side of it is around strategy, innovation, and the direction of any change that goes along in the tournament. And that's all around gathering information from broadcasters, players, coaches, fans, and then filtering that back to Alistair and Anthony and all the other staff at the BBL and creating some conversation.
Well, that's why you've got about five titles, because it's quite an expansive role. I love talking to you, Trent, about cricket because you see things differently, and I think that's really important in the sport to have different views on the game. Are there a couple of things that stand out to you from an innovation perspective that need to change?
I think this constant change is needed, and sometimes it's just a slight shift either left or right. It's not about blowing things up and starting again, because it's a really successful tournament. But I think it's you know, what I like doing is talking to cricket, you know, whether it's with you guys or whether it's just with any person around who wants to have a chat about it and see what they like and see what they would like to do and like to see. And I think, especially as a coach, it's easy to get caught up in your own little backyard or your own dugout, and you don't see what's going on behind the scenes. And because every moment's pressure as a coach, and you know, no greater sport than AFL to see that. And with the camera on the box each week. But sometimes you miss where growth is needed. And players are really good at seeing that. So it's tapping into their thought processes just so that you can be on top of any really obvious change that may be needed.
So what are you feeling and what are you hearing already from some of the reconnaissance you're doing from the players as to what they would like to see potentially change or get better?
Oh, I think the players they sometimes think, right, pace of play, how do we improve that? How do we create excitement with the fans? And sometimes it's just a throwaway line that they may use, and there might be someone I haven't spoken to, someone on Twitter or Instagram, but it's, at the moment, yeah, there's some exciting change on the horizon, but we're just working through some things, which obviously this horrible disease is slowing things down at the moment for a lot of people. But there's lots to discuss sooner than later, I reckon.
In terms of player acquisitions, I think that's a really important part of the Big Bash, and clearly that's one of the reasons you've got the job. You mentioned there's a lot more competition now. In terms of the status of the Big Bash compared to those other competitions and the places they can play across the globe, all the players, where does it sit, the Big Bash? Is it reputation sort of got it really high up there?
Yeah, it does. And obviously the nation itself is a great attraction. So there's other leagues, the C10, there's the Bangladesh Premier League, and now the Future Tours program is going to be condensed significantly because of COVID. So we have to make sure we're providing an environment for players to pique their interest, but also when we get them here, provide a really good time for them. I found that from the start space with Kevin Peterson and Luke Wright especially. They wanted to come back, and then follow that on with Sandeep Lamashane and Harris Ralph. They want to come back, and I hope then that's the same with people like Villiers and Banton in Brisbane. And you see that the Sixers and the Thunder do a really good job of providing a great environment for their overseas players. And then you want those overseas players to spread the word. So then when you talk to others, you have some experience to say, this is a great tournament. It's a really good platform to launch yourself as an international player, or it's a chance to break into an international environment, as in Harris Ralph. And he's someone who's plucked from obscurity, but he was afforded an opportunity. And also, he provided such a spark to the tournament. The more times we can get that right, the better. The more chances the competition can grow successfully.
The real box office stars, though, Trent, do we need them here for the entire campaign? This six-game sort of contract we saw for a few of those last season, does that work? Is that sustainable?
I think so. I think it works. I think Dale Steyn, in my experience, who was at the Stars, was phenomenal. Even to the point, we had a luncheon to wish him all the best as he left to go back to South Africa. Everyone was captivated by his stories and his information and his sharing of knowledge, and that gives you a boost. And it's hard to sort of measure that, but he was great with Harris Ralph. Pat Brown, who didn't play a game because of injury, he was great with him, and all our young quicks. They took so much away, as well as the coaches. So I think it's important to attract those players, and if it is for only five or six games, it's a definite bonus, especially in a squeezed international scene.
Now we think we got our season back into a really good shape, but now it's about us really becoming even more mature and building our game further and improving as the year goes on. We wanted to be a club that improved as the year went on, and hopefully we're putting ourselves in a position where we can start challenging some of the really good sides that's sitting up the top of the ladder.
Simon Goodwin, coach of the Melbourne Football Club, post-game after the win against North Melbourne, and they are 5-5, as he says, after 10 rounds, with a game in hand, as we've spoken about a bit through this season. And Jake Lever is one of the reasons they're back on track, I reckon, and his role in that defensive unit for the D's. He's good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Jake.
Thank you very much for having me, boys.
Pleasure having you on. Just tell me first, after the game on Sunday night, did you fly straight back to Queensland and then get home some ridiculous time in the morning?
Yes, we did. That was always planned for the boys. Once we flew over to Adelaide, we weren't looking forward to the trip back, that was for sure. So we got on the plane at about 10:30, flew into Brisbane Airport. I didn't think we got in there till about 2 a.m. and then had to make the long drive to Maroochydore. So I think we arrived at Twin Waters in Maroochydore at about 3:30 a.m. So it was a big day for everyone on Sunday, but we got some much-needed rest yesterday.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. In this era of compressed schedules and recovery being absolutely paramount, how do you look after yourselves physically on the back of a day like that?
Oh, I think the most important thing is getting some sleep. And now I've got a little six-month-year-old baby, which usually doesn't give me too much sleep. But my wife was lucky enough. My wife took him out for the morning. So from about 4 a.m. when I finally got to sleep, I think I got a bit of a sleep into about 9:30, 10 o'clock. So I was lucky, but some of the other boys weren't so lucky, and they were up and about with the kids at 7 a.m. So they had about 3 hours sleep. But we didn't really do much yesterday. We just had a bit of recovery as a group, and we've been using a recovery facility up in Maroochydore, so they opened their doors for about 2 hours for us, and we were lucky enough to get in there. So all the boys are thoroughly enjoying the ice bath yesterday, that's for sure.
Have you got used to it yet, Jake, about how crazy it is? I mean, obviously, back-to-back games in Adelaide, but you're flying from Queensland to play those games. You're talking about getting into your room at 3:30 in the morning. I mean, Has it got normal yet?
Oh, look, I think the compressed fixture, I think, has got normal. Sort of playing off 4 days, I think the first one I noticed when we played off 4 days was I probably didn't prepare myself mentally for that. I think physically you walk into a game and, you know, through the preseason that we're doing, you're doing a lot of, you know, 10, 12K sessions every second day anyway. So you're ready physically. It was probably more for me getting my head around the fact that you're about to go back into battle 4 days later, which probably, you know, in a normal week, in a normal AFL season, would be a main training session or a, you know, a light skill session. So that's probably just the thing that I've had to adjust to. But as you said, you know, getting in at 3:30 a.m., I'm not sure you'll ever get used to that. But definitely the compressed fixture. I think most boys now are really jumping on sort of the mindfulness bandwagon in terms of getting themselves ready for the game and then also really looking after themselves physically. I think that's probably been the biggest shift this year.
And the person that I immediately think of to help get you through that is Darren Burgess. And, you know, he had a massive impact at Port Adelaide. He's come to your footy club, and we see how well you're finishing off games throughout the season, to be honest, but particularly the last couple of weeks. Are you starting to see tangible benefits out of Darren already, do you think?
Oh, look, I think the pre-season that we did, there was definitely some benefits for it. And when the compressed fixture came out, obviously Burgo, coming from an EPL background, soccer background, where they play every 2 or 3 days, he was definitely puffing his chest out. So we love to have a bit of a joke with Burgo that he loves to puff his chest out. But it's been awesome just to be able to get the experience from that. Because as you said, it is different. It's something that players have had to get used to, and the recovery element of the game now for every team, you can see that it's going to become paramount. And as you said, we're finishing off games really well. Not only is that coming from, I think, the recovery base physically, as I said, I think that it's something that mentally we're really honing in on, that mental side of the game and recovering through the week, and then being able to come out and play 4 quarters of footy, which we're very, very happy about.
Jake Levy's joined us from the D's, sitting there in the back half doing good things at the moment. And I was watching with interest on the weekend, Jake, and seeing you in action. And it was almost the Jake Levy that everyone fell in love with in your first couple of years of footy. Is it the most comfortable you've and confident you've been at the D's in this last little patch?
Oh, look, I think so. I think that it's probably a little bit of a different role. I'm not going to say a different role, but definitely more added responsibility. I think that, you know, we've obviously got big Stevie May down there that takes the big key forward down deep. And then right now we've got Adam Tomlinson down in the back half. So he's sort of playing that third tall role. So I've sort of moved into that second key position player, and, you know, speaking to the coaches, and I'm more comfortable at the minute in that position because I'm getting to more contests. I'm being able to be in more contests, and the ability for me to be able to play on those big guys, you know, you sort of, when you miss footy, you sort of maybe feel that you've lost that ability to do that, but the last couple of weeks, I feel like I've got my confidence back and really just trying to, you know, do the things that, as you said, doing at Adelaide, and I think that my first year at Melbourne, it took me a little while to get going, but I played some good games before I got injured, but yeah, at the minute, I'm just really enjoying playing down there. With the seven guys that we've got at the minute, I think we've got a really good mix down there in the back half, and you know, we just want to be one of the best defensive units in the AFL, and hopefully we can become that over the next little period and push ourselves towards finals.
Well, we know the AFL is rolling on at the moment, Whitey, until such time as something makes it stop, and hopefully that doesn't happen. But lower tier football is a different conversation. We're not quite sure what that looks like. The financial crisis hitting the AFL clubs has affected their affiliations with VFL teams and reserves teams. And Josh Fraser was involved at the Carlton Football Club as part of their coaching of the Carlton VFL team. Of course, that has gone to the Shires at the minute. But the Northern Bull Ants, who they merged with not long ago, looks like they're going to have a rebirth. And I want to find out more about it. Josh Fraser himself, the coach of the Northern Bull Ants, joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Fraser.
G'day, Half. How are you, mate?
I'm very, very well. Explain to me what's happening with the Bull Ants. I'm seeing all this stuff on social media. I haven't quite worked it out yet. What's the future looking like for the Ants?
Well, we're hopeful it's bright, Half. I mean, we obviously really disappointed with the way things finished in March this year with our alignment with the Carlton Footy Club. But I guess the best way to sum it up would be that there's been a group of people who are really passionate about the Bull Ants, going way back to when they were the Preston Bull Ants, but certainly in more recent times when they were the Northern Bull Ants and the Northern Blues. And that passion probably still exists to a point where we don't want to see the footy club drift off into the abyss. So we've been able to assemble a really passionate, impressive group of people, and we're doing everything we can to try and keep the club alive. And the ambition and goal is to play in the VFL next year. So it's a big task, mate. It's a really big task, particularly given the current climate, but it's one that we're really passionate about and feel strongly about. And I think Preston or the Northern Bull Ants should have a place in Victorian football and in that talent pathway, and it's something that we're going to fight really hard for.
It's a very famous club, a great history, and of course serves a really important role in that part of Melbourne, as you say. When it was announced at the start of the year, Fraser, that the affiliation with Carlton and the Blues, Northern Blues, was going to end, did you think your time in footy was just about done?
I hadn't thought about it to that point, to be honest, Half. I mean, I didn't think my time in footy would be done. I mean, I always see myself being involved in some way, shape or form, coaching-wise, but I guess this opportunity to invest in football in a different set of circumstances and, you know, to be working behind the scenes with a group of people to try and keep a footy club alive, has been something that I've never experienced, and it's been a fantastic process to this point. And I think just being able to work with you know, some of these people, I mean, we've been able to get Stephen Nick on board, who has just got an enormous reputation through sporting administration, both football and basketball. Bobby Tregear, who's been heavily involved in the governance side of football for a number of years, right through to people that are looking after events and marketing and branding and those sorts of things. So it's been, it's just been a great experience, one that I'm grateful to be a part of. And as I said earlier, it's one that we all feel really strongly about. And we all believe that the Bull Ants should have a place in Victorian footy, and particularly a really strong footprint in that northern, the northern regions, helping develop young talent, both male and female, and also connecting pretty heavily to the community. That's going to be a really big focus of ours.
Has it helped you as well, Josh? You kind of half answered the question, but it was a shock to everybody what's happened. I mean, you would never have thought we'd be having this discussion, you know, 6 months ago, let alone 12 months ago. But just to help you cope with someone that was affected as much as you were?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable point, Whitey. I mean, it's definitely been challenging, and we tend to focus a lot on the football side of things because that's what we do. But it's been challenging on a number of different layers for so many people. But I think to keep yourself occupied, and I am really passionate about this. It's not something that I'm doing just to fill in time. It's become a real passion. And even when I was coaching the Northern Blues and an employee of Carlton, I really felt strongly about that connection with the Preston Bull Ants and the history and tradition that that club possessed. So it was an easy thing for me to jump onto and be a part of. But it certainly kept me stimulated and motivated in recent times. And you know, we're hoping for a really positive outcome. But we understand, too, that it's going to be a real fight on our hands, but it's one that we're up for. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm really confident and grateful to the group of people that we've got involved.
Rob Wright is an outstanding person to be involved, the Collingwood Super Netball team. He's the coach, and he's been good enough to join us this morning. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, guys. How are you?
We are well, thank you. How are you coaching in Hubville? How's it going in hub life as opposed to normal day-to-day life for Super Netball in previous years?
Oh, look, it's certainly different, but I probably just want to put a shout-out to all the Vics, like, you know, stage four, like, everyone's doing it tough back home and doing a fantastic job around that. So I feel like we're pretty privileged to be... even though you're away from family and friends, which is always difficult, but compared to back home, I feel like we're really lucky, and at times you feel a bit guilty for the freedoms we have. It's a good place to be, really, at the moment.
What about the on-court at the moment with the girls? Dropped the first two games, the first one against the Vixens and then the Lightning on the weekend. And we talked to Maddie and Kelsey a fair bit on this program. We love having them a part of our world. They're back on court for the first time in a long time. How have you seen the integration of returning players and new players into this Collingwood team?
Yeah, look, it was always going to be a little bit different for us. Certainly, even for the month leading into this comp, the restrictions with our training meant our first literal game was in mid-season. We actually weren't able to have a pre-season match because of the restrictions around numbers, etc. So we always felt, oh, it's going to be learning on the fly, and it certainly has been that. So I'm hoping that, you know, in reality, like, trading is always good, but, you know, probably, as you guys will know, you learn so much more in a game, and so we're learning on the fly, and I reckon it's going to take some time, but hey, I don't reckon the first two games defines this season for us at all. Like, it's about, even though there's only 14 rounds, you know, to me it's about probably really building and making sure that we're there come finals time. And, you know, to me, if we could sneak into the finals, that's what we're about, and then all bets are off, really, and you start again.
It's we're really keen to speak to you, Rob, for a number of reasons, but particularly around the 2-point shot and how you've seen that, and how it's affected the way that you coach the team. What's been your initial thoughts?
Oh, look, and I think certainly in the first two rounds, like, I think we've really seen where that 2-point shot has really got a team back into the game. Like, you look at the game on Swift's Fever, and it looked like Swift had it for all money just with a couple of minutes to go, and then all of a sudden Janiel puts up 3 2-points in a row and it gets back to a point. So it absolutely made for a really fantastic finish. So from a spectator point of view, I think that's really good. Certainly changes a little bit how you coach, because generally we've always worked in our game, like, defensively, you always want to try and push people further away from the post, like, to make life a little bit harder. But the 2-point shot really is only a mid-range shot, so it's a really difficult one. So it's really trying to explore different options around how you counter that. And look, I still think we're really playing with that at the moment. I don't think we've quite found the right answers about how to do it. Admittingly, in our last game, Lightning hasn't really put up a lot of 2-point shots. I think they've put the lowest number up in the competition. So in some ways, they've probably played quite standard netball. Yes, they put up a lot in the first game, and it really took them away. But yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how it rolls across the season. But again, it's going to be a bit of trial and error for us in real life to see what's what. But it just gives us a new dimension and something that I think hopefully people will embrace, and we'll see how it looks at across the season.
Now, Gabby Ruffles, we were watching her yesterday morning. Whitey, she was aiming to become a back-to-back winner of the US Women's Amateur Championship. It didn't quite go her way. Successful, of course, last year. Not so much yesterday, but she's been good enough to front up and talk to us today on The Breakfast Club. Gabby, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you on. How are you feeling today, after what unfolded yesterday, and things were so tight for 38 holes, the final of the US Women's Amateur, didn't quite go your way, but how are you feeling?
Yeah, at the moment, I'm pretty tired, pretty exhausted. It was a long week, especially with the delay that we had. So we played, on Friday we played 36 holes, on Saturday we played 36 holes, and then obviously yesterday I played 38 holes. So it was on a very hilly golf course. So it was tiring, to say the least. But, I mean, it was just such a cool week to defend at the US Women's Amateur, and it was such a cool experience for sure.
So 36 3 days in a row, and there was more golf before then. Do you know how many holes you ended up playing for the entire week?
I'm not sure. I haven't calculated it, but I played two practice rounds, two rounds of stroke play, and then I think six rounds of match play, maybe more, seven. So, I mean... I was talking about this earlier, but I think it's one of the toughest and most grueling weeks in golf. Like a normal PGA or LPGA event, you're just playing 4 days, and this one is just a whole lot of golf. But it was super cool.
Yeah, and you were down in a lot of your events or your matches, and you did extremely well to fight and find a way to get through to the final. When you're playing so much, is it just everything on autopilot, or do you go in waves with your swing and waves with your confidence because you're playing so many holes?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's just a crazy week, roller coaster week. I mean, you're playing for so long, you can't expect your swing, I guess, to be good for that many holes and that many shots. You just kind of have to know that you're going to be making mistakes out there, and you got to stay super patient, especially at the golf course that we were playing at. It was, I think, one of the toughest golf courses I've ever played in my life. The rough was super thick. The greens were so fast. I think I had about four putts the whole week where I thought I could be aggressive with it. So these greens were just crazy, and the course was crazy, and I mean, the whole week, yeah. I mean, it was just a roller coaster week, that's for sure.
And what about the last couple of holes being a roller coaster? We were watching, I think it was the 36th hole, where Rose pulled it into the left rough and then chunked it down the fairway a little bit. And we were watching going, oh, we're back in this. And you're up on the green as she's playing her third shot. And I called it a real intimidation pose, Gabby. I'm not sure if you did it on purpose or not, but you look pretty intimidating up on the green because you're already there saying as if to Rose, where are you? What's taking you so long? And then she plays that chip shot to a foot. What did you think then?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll admit, like, I thought that was my chance. Rose is such a great player. She never faltered all day. She never made one mistake. And, I mean, if she missed the green, she would chip it to a foot and get up and down. She didn't miss many fairways. And when she did miss that one on 18, it was really out of the ordinary. And I was shocked. And I thought this could be my chance. But, I mean... the player that she is, she recovered amazingly, and I will never forget that pitch shot of hers coming down 18, that third shot. It just landed perfectly on the green and rolled up perfectly, could have even gone in and went to a foot. It was kind of heartbreaking at the time because, I mean, I did think that this could be the chance that I could be done with the match, but she's a great player, and she's super clutch, and... yeah, I mean, she deserved it.
So, Gabby, what we want to sort of throw it forward now briefly, rather than sort of revisit too much of the trauma of those last few holes. What are you going to do now? Because you've won the US Amateur, you've then backed it up the next year and almost won it again. I know you're relatively new to the game of golf, but professional, is that on the horizon for you now?
Yes, for sure. I was actually meant to play LPGA Q School this year. That would have been around this time. But with everything going on with the coronavirus, they canceled that. So it's kind of pushed my plans back a little bit. I have 1 year left at USC. I'm in college in the States over here. So I have 1 year left to get my degree. So kind of sights are just set on that. I'll graduate in May of next year to play one more season at USC, but then after that, I'm definitely looking to turn pro.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.